This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Navarra Live. I'm Michael Walker. On this Wednesday evening, I'm joined by Femi Nylander, writer, author, filmmaker. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again.
We have a packed show lined up for you tonight. A Tory MP has today defected to the Labour Party and brought her pretty right-wing politics with her. Peter Mandelson has decided to go after the Green Party and will be looking at the latest effects of climate change as catastrophic flooding has hit southern Brazil. Straight into our first story. Israel's assault on Rafah has continued overnight, and the IDF has released this footage of its so-called limited operation on Gaza's southernmost city. After taking military control of the Rafah crossing, there are signs that Israel's closest allies don't believe the assault will be merely limited. US President Joe Biden has paused his country's shipment of 3,500 bombs to Israel over concerns that Benjamin Netanyahu will use them in a major assault against Rafah. 1,800 of those promised weapons are 2,000-pound bombs. They're enormous munitions that cause extensive damage in built-up areas like Rafah. The New York Times reports this on the pause. One US official said the administration began reviewing arms shipments last month when it became clear that Israel seemed to be reaching a decision on a Rafah operation. Mr. Biden initially took the position that Israel should not attack Rafah without a plan to effectively minimize civilian casualties. But in recent weeks, the White House has increasingly indicated that it did not believe such a plan was even possible. Israeli government spokesperson Avi Heiman was asked about the pause at a news conference.
One Israeli analyst described the Biden administration's withholding of munitions from Israel by saying that the Biden administration is tying Israel's hands and preventing it from defeating Hamas. Do you agree?
Joel, thank you very much for the question. I've obviously seen these reports, reports coming out from unnamed sources on the American side. I can refer you to statements made this morning by the IDF chief of staff. I could refer you back to the Americans if they indeed have or are making these statements. I personally, as the Israeli government, do not have anything to add on these reports.
The pause in US weapons transfers doesn't seem to have dampened Israel's enthusiasm for a possible all-out attack on Rafah, with Defense Minister Yoav Gallant promising this. Yesterday, I ordered the IDF to enter the Rafah area, seize the crossing, and carry out its missions. This operation will continue until we eliminate Hamas in the Rafah area and the entire Gaza Strip, or until the first hostage returns. We are ready to make compromises in order to release hostages, but if this option is not available, we will deepen the operation. This will happen all over the Strip, in the south, in the center, and in the north. Hamas only understands force, so we will intensify our action, and the military pressure will result in us crushing the Hamas organization. Now, it seems a bit strange to say Hamas will only understand force when Hamas on Monday said that they would agree to the terms put forward by the Egyptians and the Qataris, who are hosting the negotiations. Obviously, Israel rejected that in part because Israel's red line seems to be we'll only agree to a pause in fighting if we then get to continue the war and destroy you, which aren't particularly good terms that many organizations would accept. The pause in shipments also comes in the context of a long-awaited State Department report into whether Israel has broken humanitarian law in Gaza. It was supposed to be published today, but publication has now been delayed, with the State Department providing no comment on why, according to Politico. The State Department also hasn't committed to a specific timeline for the report's release, but one anonymous source told Politico the delay would be less than a week. Now, we shouldn't expect too much from that report. It's unlikely to find Israel in serious breach of international law, given that that would implicate the United States in supporting Israel in committing those crimes. It would also have unacceptable consequences for some businesses, with some US industrialists already rubbing their hands at the prospect of Gaza coming under even more Israeli control. The Wall Street Journal has published this piece by American businessman and investor Andy Kessler. In it, Kessler lays out his plan for what he calls Palestinian prosperity, which involves Israel building weapons factories in Gaza and the West Bank. So marvelling at Israel's air defence systems like the Iron Dome and David Sling, Kessler writes this: Israel should eventually build factories in Gaza and the West Bank to manufacture these systems. There's no better way to turn an enemy into an ally than to give him a job. That may sound far-fetched, but history is on my side. After Germany's surrender in 1945, amid a landscape of destroyed cities, the Marshall Plan helped rebuild Germany into a peaceful ally. The reconstruction of Japan started during occupation under General Douglas MacArthur. We did a pretty good job because, wouldn't you know it, behind China and the US, Japan is third in the world in global manufacturing output. Germany is fourth, Italy seventh. Now, there is a very key difference here, right? Which is, you know, post-war Japan, post-war Germany, success stories. Now, if it had been the case that the Americans and, you know, the Allies were trying to kick out ethnic Germans or ethnic Japanese from their homes to replace them with Americans or Brits, right? And that was a continuous process which was going on decade over decade over decade, trying to shrink their, you know, political landmass and deny them the ability to govern their own countries, then maybe the post-war Japan and post-war Germany wouldn't have been such success stories, right? This, if you want to go the whole hog and say, oh, let's make, you know, post-war Palestine like Germany and like Japan, well, you're going to have to give them very defined borders, withdraw the Israelis, stop the settlements, because we weren't doing that in any of those countries. Kessler goes on, unbelievably. So he has more to say, this man. So turn Gaza and the West Bank into factory floors, assembling defense systems, although maybe add the explosives elsewhere. Bring great jobs and a middle class to their mostly poor inhabitants. They can even work on Saturdays. That's in contrast to Jewish people who rest on Saturdays. Without handouts from the politicized United Nations, turn Gaza into Hong Kong, a place of free trade, or Mexico, a neighbor with a cheap but effective labor force. Now, this article reads almost as if it's a parody. You know, so we did have to check, is this, you know, are we being fooled by sort of an offensive, albeit, but is this a parodic article in the Wall Street Journal? This guy appears to be a serious business commentator. And of course, actually, this has sort of been a talking point ever since, or the start of this war, where sort of people say, oh, Gaza could have been the Singapore on the Mediterranean if only they'd wanted to spend their money on development instead of tunnels. Again, one, they weren't allowed to bring in enough concrete or any of the equipment that would help development come to pass. Also, it's pretty difficult to build a stable, coherent society when you're living under siege and when your people are being denied a nation. Femi, I'm not sure if Andy Kessler's ideas are, or to what extent they might be, sort of representative of a broader sort of set of opinions within sort of the American business class. But it does seem like there are sort of lots of people who are very naive to the fact that you can't just sort of bury a national question. You can't just say, oh, we'll create some jobs there, and then they'll all forget about the fact that they're being ethnically cleansed from their homes.
I mean, it's just disingenuous. They don't want Palestinians there. They don't want Palestinians to remain there. They want to push them all out and turn it into part of Israel. So this is just fodder. This is just lies. This is what Israel does. It lies and 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 it lies. I mean, we know that Israel loves creating bombs. We know the UK loves creating bombs. We know the US loves creating bombs. We know that generally, Germany is creating bombs. We know that European countries and their outposts in the Middle East love a good old weapons factory. But I think the reality, of course, is that Israel wants this to be part of Israel. And we saw this when, I can't remember her name, but that bonkers lady, the settler, said that we need to invade Gaza so that our people can see the beaches, can go to the beach and enjoy the coastline and this, that, and the rest. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just gaslighting, really. It's gaslighting, and it's bonkers, and it's Israel. It's what Israel does. It gaslights, it lies, comes up with wild scenarios, and it throws it out there because it knows it has the impunity to not be challenged on any of it whatsoever.
Next story. We've got some good news and some bad news for you on climate change today. To begin with what's good. Last year, and for the first time ever, renewable energy provided more than 30% of the world's annual energy supply. The finding comes from Ember. They're a global energy think tank. And they show that the majority of renewable energy still comes from hydroelectric projects. That's principally dams. But all the growth in renewable energy has come from wind and solar, which combined now make up more than 13% of total energy supply. Now, as in previous years, the boost is driven principally by China, who alone accounted for 51% of new solar generation and 60% of new wind. So really phenomenal figures. And the speed of the global rollout of solar, which according to the think tank is, quote, accelerating faster than anyone thought possible, has principally been driven by a fall in the cost of producing solar panels. Now, this is, again, an incredible statistic. The cost of solar power halved last year, and that's despite a surge in demand. So it wasn't they were sort of just trying to get rid of this overcapacity because no one wanted it. Everyone wanted it. They were just building more. This was all thanks to an explosion in manufacturing capacity. Again, that surge in production capacity has been largely taking place in China. So that's the good news. And when it comes to a clean energy transition, it's clear we're moving in the right direction. The bad news is this. It's clear that transition is not happening nearly fast enough. The Guardian has polled 380 authors of IPCC reports, so they're the gold standard in climate science, and asked them to predict how high temperatures will rise this century. And 77% of them, so that's a whopping majority, expect temperatures to rise above 2.5 degrees Celsius this century. Only 6% of climate scientists believed we would hold temperatures below 1.5 degrees Celsius. That's, of course, the UN's official target. Now, one reason for pessimism from climate scientists might be data on sea temperatures. Analysis by the BBC shows the world's oceans have broken temperature records every single day over the past year. Every single day over the past year. Phenomenal. The records were also not just broken, they were smashed. So on this chart, each of the grey lines represents a year between 1979 and 2022, and each line shows the temperature on every day in the given year. The red line shows the temperature on each day in 2023, and the purple line shows the temperature every day in 2024 so far. Now, the gap between 2023 and 2024 and the other years is massive, right? According to the BBC, around 47 days in this period smashed the record for that day by at least 0.3 degrees Celsius, and they say that never before in the satellite era had the margin of record been this big, right? So we are seeing an increase every day hotter than any, that date on any of the previous 40 years, and the increase being higher than any of the increases we've ever really seen in the past. Very, very worrying. A marine biologist in Liverpool explained to the BBC's climate editor why oceans warming so quickly is such a problem.
The big thing that I've seen is species aren't all moving at the same rate. So things are moving further north, but not at the same speed. So all the community compositions are changing everywhere because different species are moving at different rates. I find it quite sad because, I mean, nature's never static. The environment's always changing and species respond. The problem with climate change is it's happening too quickly for evolution to catch up with it, which is why we're seeing all these shifts, because species can't evolutionarily adapt to it quick enough.
So Nova, this is a really disruptive process for ecosystems.
I think if I was a barnacle, I'd be quite worried, yes.
Of course, it's not just barnacles that should be worried. Global heating of the sea has caused mass bleaching of coral reefs. These are a critical element in the ocean ecosystem and home to around a quarter of all marine species. So when coral reefs turn white and die, they can no longer support much of that life. And this also matters for us humans. Warmer seas give extra energy to tropical storms, meaning more intense hurricane seasons. They can also melt ice sheets, meaning sea level rises. And they could even disrupt the Gulf Stream, which would be really bad, really catastrophic. I'm not going to go into the details now, but that is something we do not want to happen. As to what's causing the dramatic increase, well, last month, mechanical engineer and climate expert John Abraham said this to PBS NewsHour.
Well, if you want me to quantify the effect, and this is just off the cuff, this is a rough estimate based on my intuition, I'd say it's about half global warming, and maybe a third of it is El Nino. And then the remainder, maybe 20% or so, is a question mark. And that 20% could be some extra global warming that we hadn't accounted for, but it could be something else. But the majority of this, and the real reason we're setting records every year, is global warming. But as you pointed out, this year is the scientific term is bonkers year. This is off the charts. And it's more than we would have normally expected, even with an El Nino.
So there's a couple of other factors that I have read about being possibly complicit here. This huge volcanic eruption that happened a while ago that spit a ton of moisture up into the atmosphere, which can warm the atmosphere. Solar cycles, also the elimination of a lot of pollution from shipping, which paradoxically, it's wonderful for human health, but it's taking this umbrella off the oceans, which can also warm the oceans. Are those factors that you consider as well?
They could be, and some scientists are considering those. I'm not sold. And the reason I'm not sold is we are seeing an incredible amount of heat in specific locations, and in particular in the Atlantic Ocean. And we're seeing other parts of the planet that have lower surface temperatures. So the patterns of warming that we're seeing don't jive with some of the other options that you just mentioned, but they are under consideration by my colleagues.
So it's that point about shipping that actually sort of I'd heard the most about. And I think it's because it's a narrative which appeals to journalists like myself, which is to say we implemented this ostensibly very good regulation, which meant that ships pumped out less sulfur, which is very toxic, but it had this unintended consequence that sulfur, as well as being toxic, does have an effect of blocking out the sun. So if you get rid of that form of pollution, actually that increases the heating of the ocean. As I say, that's the one that's been sort of focused on most by, I think, journalists, because it's sort of interesting. Oh, we tried to do something good and something bad ended up happening. As you heard there from that engineer, he thinks that's a fairly small part of the story. The big story here is climate change. He's saying 50%. And then after that, it's El Nino, which is the cyclical process whereby temperatures get hotter for a few months or a year or so, around every 2.5 years. Moving on to the people currently feeling the sharpest end of climate change. In Brazil, in the southern state of Rio Grande do Sul, at least 95 people have been killed and 130 are missing after record-breaking flooding. Days of torrential rain last week caused rivers to overflow and a hydroelectric dam to collapse. Large parts of the state's capital, Porto Alegre, are now under water. 150,000 people have had to leave their homes, with a total of 1.4 million people affected by the floods. According to the state governor, quote, "The state is facing a warlike situation." He went on to say, "This is one of those events that will go down in history." Brazil's president, Lula, has traveled to the region by helicopter and promised federal help in the recovery. That will need to be forthcoming and fast. An estimated 80% of Porto Alegre's population do not have access to running water. And Lula has also linked the crises to international failures. In comments to the Washington Post, Lula blamed the devastation in Rio Grande do Sul on the failures of the global community to respond to climate change. He said there was a historic debt. Poorer countries that have historically emitted few greenhouse gases, he said, are suffering from the pollution of wealthier nations. Now, to link back to the story that started this segment, 30% of the globe's energy coming from renewables might sound pretty good, and it's a movement in the right direction, but it's clearly not yet good enough. Next story. Natalie Elphick, formerly the Tory MP for Dover, has defected to Labour. Just moments before PMQs was due to start, Elphick, circled in red here, crossed the floor to take her seat amongst Labour MPs. And this was Elphick explaining her reasons for defecting.
So under Rishi Sunak, he is the man who said he would stop the boats. And yet when we look at this year alone, it's record numbers of small boats arrivals. So he's not stopping the boats and he's letting the country down. Well, meanwhile, under Labour, they are clear that it is important to have defence and they want to make sure that they have good national security. So I think we should have confidence that Labour are the party who will tackle this issue of the small boats crossings.
It's a completely incoherent answer. She's saying Rishi Sunak hasn't done enough to stop the boats. By the way, in the past, as we'll sort of talk about later, she said that Labour want open borders, essentially. Then she goes on to this complete non sequitur, which is Labour will invest in defence. You know, now the military has nothing to do with small boats. Keir Starmer definitely hasn't said he's going to use gunships to turn them around. So she says Rishi Sunak isn't stopping the boats. Labour will spend money on the military, therefore Labour will stop the boats. It doesn't make any sense, right? It's completely incoherent. Potentially, this was a somewhat incoherent move. And as I say, this is a big change of heart from Elphick. Just a year ago, she penned this article for the Daily Express. So it said, don't trust Labour on immigration. They really want open borders. And she said, this year needs to be a turning point in our efforts to tackle illegal immigration. Luckily, Keir Starmer, or luckily for Elphick, Keir Starmer has a very short memory. Speaking about his latest MP, he was gleeful.
I'm delighted to welcome Natalie Elphick to the Labour Party. She's got a strong track record on issues such as housing. She's on the front line when it comes to the crisis of small boats. And the reason that she's given for joining the Labour Party is very, very important, because I think she speaks for very many Tory voters in saying that the Tory party has changed. It's left the centre ground. But equally, the Labour Party has changed. And we are very clearly the party of the national interest, of country first, party second. And I look forward to working with her on the mission to deliver the real change that this country desperately needs.
So he's saying, we are the ones who have entered the centre ground. We can see that by this incredibly right-wing Tory joining our ranks. You might have gathered, I'm not sure Starmer should be so excited to welcome Natalie Elphick to Labour's fold. Her track record isn't exactly scandal-free, and her politics seem an unlikely fit, even for Starmer's right-leaning Labour Party. Until 2019, Dover was represented by this man, Tory MP Charlie Elphick. He's seen here with his wife, Natalie Elphick, leaving court after he was found guilty of 3 counts of sexual assault against 2 women. Charlie Elphick's behaviour was pretty lurid, and according to witness testimony, included chasing one of his victims around his house singing, "I'm a naughty Tory, I'm a naughty Tory." At the time of the conviction, Natalie Elphick supported him, writing this in The Sun after he was jailed. Charlie is charming, wealthy, charismatic and successful, attractive and attracted to women. All things that in today's climate made him an easy target for dirty politics and false allegations. So I resolved to stand by him while he fought off these allegations in court and decided that I would leave him after that. It didn't quite work out that way. Following an unfair trial during the COVID-19 pandemic, I believe that Charlie was convicted in a terrible miscarriage of justice. It was obvious to me from reading the evidence during lockdown that the criminal allegations against him were complete nonsense, and I still believe they are. But Natalie Elphick didn't just stand by her man. She replaced him as Dover MP in 2019. And then, according to the Standards Committee, used her parliamentary position to try to influence her husband's criminal prosecution. Now, that ruling by the Standards Committee led to Natalie Elphick and 2 other Tory MPs being suspended from Parliament for a day, with her behaviour described as corrosive to the rule of law. Aside from those controversies, Elphick's politics have, in many ways, been pretty standard for a Tory. Like the rest of her party, she voted against banning fire and rehire practices, which led to this happening when she decided to visit a protest by P&O workers who had been subject to fire and rehire in her constituency.
You voted for fire and rehire! You voted for fire and rehire! Shame on you, man!
Shame on you! 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 Shame on you!
It's a great clip because it looks like she's sort of beginning to join in the chant, shame on you, until she realises they're talking about her. Proof that Tories and picket lines don't really go together. There are other issues which show Natalie Elphick isn't just any old Tory, though. She's on the hard right when it comes to migration and has consistently denied the existence of any refugee crisis, going so far as to brand all asylum seekers as economic migrants in a 2022 Daily Mail article. And in that same year, she made this intervention on the Rwanda bill.
Does my honourable friend agree with me that it's absolutely vital that we speed up these deportations and give effect to the new Rwanda agreement as well, without the twists and the tricks of those who put political preference for uncontrolled open borders above our country's safety?
Along with her anti-migrant politics, Elphick has also been known for her hostility to the England football team. After the Euro 2020 final, when Marcus Rashford missed a penalty and suffered online racist abuse, Elphick posted this to a Tory group chat. They lost. Would it be ungenerous to suggest Rashford should have spent more time perfecting his game and less time playing politics? Now, by playing politics, she meant trying to get kids school meals over the COVID pandemic. Now, after that message was leaked, Elphick was forced into a grovelling apology. Of course, Elphick isn't the only Tory to switch to Labour in recent weeks. In late April, former Health Minister and NHS doctor Dan Poulter took the Labour whip after saying the Tories couldn't be trusted with the health service. The One Nation Tory who tended to the left of the party said he wouldn't be standing in the next general election, but would like to stay on as an advisor to Labour on health policy. Like Poulter, Elphick has also said she'll be standing down as an MP at the next election. That means this move is all about messaging. But while one can see the obvious PR advantage of a moderate Tory doctor defecting to Labour, it's harder to see how it adds up for a hard right Tory with a history of defending a sex offender. Femi, Labour doesn't let just anyone sit as a Labour MP. Diane Abbott and Jeremy Corbyn are still, of course, sitting as independents. Natalie Elphick makes the grade, though. What do you make of it?
I think here is where sometimes we have to be a bit self-critical and think back and think kind of what brought us here. Because if we move back a few years, what do we see within Labour? We see something to basically set the ground for Labour's support of this genocide today. We see a purging of many of the real leftists in the Labour Party. We see the scapegoating of many of these people as anti-Semites. We saw that with Jackie Walker. We saw that with a number of individuals, and we saw that with Jeremy Corbyn in many ways. And many of us made mistakes. I mean, I know that Ash herself called Jackie a crank, and I would say that, well, look, the real cranks are the people who are now coming into the new Labour Party as it is constituted now, as a party which has always had a genocidal slant to it. I mean, it's always been a party that is part of a country which is a colonial country, but it's always had elements as well which are good and have helped set up institutions like the NHS and this, that, and the rest. And so this shift to the right, in the Labour Party, to the point in which it is becoming kind of open, is basically becoming Tory-like, which has existed since the days of Blair, but has accelerated itself somewhat now and has kind of led to a new swathe of, so to speak, Blairite politics, well, genocidal politics, is inextricably linked, of course, to the fact that people such as David Mensah, who was the replacement for Elon Levy as spokesman for Israel's genocidal horrific crimes and chief liar and propagandist to the UK public on behalf of Israel, were part of the Labour Party. I believe he was head of Labour Friends of Israel. That was a little bit earlier than this. And so I think Labour Party has been on a slow decline, but I do think that now that Labour is openly supporting genocide, openly supporting the starvation of children, openly supporting, I mean, we saw Emily Thornberry this morning. And as I say, Ash did do well against Emily Thornberry this morning and brought her out. So it's not an unleveled attack, but it is an acknowledgement that the ideas that were being kind of bandied around there, that the Labour Party had an endemic problem with anti-Semitism, were basically, in many ways, a witch hunt to drive out some of the people who were anti-Zionists from the party. And anti-Zionists generally tend to be the kind of people who do not like the murder of children, who do not like colonial projects, who do not like years and years and years of ethnic cleansing, who do not like destruction and death and blowing up tents with tanks, as we've seen in Rafah today. And so generally, they tend to be people whose politics also align with other actual leftist positions of equality and justice and life and fairness. And so when you purge your party of anti-Zionists on false accusations of anti-Semitism, then your party will realign itself as a party that will then eventually be welcome ground for any old racist or Tory to join, I think.
I mean, do you really think those things are causal? I mean, I understand people disagree on how the anti-Semitism row in Labour was handled. But I mean, the fact that Jeremy Corbyn lost, then Keir Starmer won, doesn't seem to me to have that much to do with people's sort of positions on, any one person's disciplinary case between the years of 2015 and 2019. I think there's probably a sort of bigger story here. I don't know, how would you respond?
Of course, it's not literally a causal thing. It's just one example of the environment. I mean, there were plenty. The idea was that the Labour Party was endemic with anti-Semitism. I mean, Andrew Neil asked Aaron, why is the Labour Party endemic with anti-Semitism? And Aaron agreed the Labour Party is endemic with anti-Semitism. The environment of the Labour Party supposedly being this kind of anti-Semitic hellhole, when on the other side of the pond, you've got people like Boris Johnson being elected prime minister after saying that black people are pickaninnies with watermelon smiles. It's ludicrous, the idea that you can focus on the Labour Party as being specifically anti-Semitic and more anti-Semitic than other parties, whereas the actual parties who are massively racist. And I mean, look at Nigel Farage's history as an anti-Semite. The guy was walking around at school doing Nazi salutes. It was, and we can see that now. Anyone can see that now, because I go to protests, and as soon as I mention anything Israel, I'm screamed at anti-Semite. I went to a protest. I went to a Palestine protest in London. And I tried to, and I saw, I, on the way there, I saw the Israeli counter-protest. So I went in, I started shouting, 1, 2, 3, 4, occupation, no more, 5, 6, 7, 8, Israel is a terrorist state in the middle of all these Zionists. And the first thing that came out of the other mouths was, anti-Semite, and they ran at me, they rushed me, and the police grabbed me and said, what are you doing here? This, that, and the rest. And so it's obvious to anyone now that this anti-Semitism, the extent to which this anti-Semitism accusation has been leveled against people, has always been and has helped to set the ground for a genocidal campaign. Of course, anti-Semitism is a problem if people are anti-Semitic, but the idea that it's a problem that's bigger than anti-Black racism, the idea that had Jeremy Corbyn at the height of his premiership accepted a donation from someone who said they wanted to shoot Margaret Hodge, and she, looking at her, made him want to hate all Jewish women, and that would have been accepted. No, but that's what happened with Diane Abbott, right? So the double standards are clear, and the reality is clear. And it might not be, I'm not saying it's causal that one person making a single remark led to this. I'm saying that that environment where, as you said it yourself, Jeremy Corbyn lost, Keir Starmer won, Keir Starmer's leader. Keir Starmer is the one who is now being a duplicitous little slime ball and lying and justifying the starvation of children and flip-flopping on every single policy he has ever kind of promised, and welcoming open racists and rabid Tories into the Labour Party. And so, of course, anything that caused Keir Starmer to become the leader of the Labour Party, and the efforts of the Israel lobby within the Labour Party to create a party which is basically another far-right party, does have a historical and a causal impact on where we sit today and why we have a two-party system with no one within that two-party system willing to challenge an ongoing genocide, and which is horrific, and which makes me. I mean, I grew up reading about Vietnam. I grew up reading about Cambodia. I grew up even the Iraq War. I was too young during the time. I'm only 29 now. I was too young during the Iraq War and during Libya to really get a grip on what's going on. But this is just, I mean, it's, everyone can see it's horrific. And so we do sometimes need to think back to what the causal links were, and where we could have done better in a historical context. And lots of people made this mistake. Lots of people bought in. And as I say, anti-Semitism is wrong, and anyone who is anti-Semitic is wrong. But the idea that anti-Semitism was endemic within the Labour Party was utilised and has been utilised to bring the Labour Party to where it is today, which is purged of any real anti-Zionist elements, and happy to support an ongoing genocide. And I do think that's undeniable.
Yeah, I mean, my sort of opinions on the anti-Semitism row, you know, on record a number of times. I mean, I think there clearly was an attack by a pro-Israel lobby on the Labour Party, which sort of all the right wing were very much happy to get along with. I mean, one of the big reasons it was effective is because the Corbyn operation was very, very incompetent on that issue. They constantly put out sort of contradictory messaging. They never took a strong line on anything. They didn't make a particularly strong effort to sort of say there is this big distinction between anti-Semitism and being anti-Israel or anti-Zionist. And I think they just sort of left this sort of messy vacuum, which meant that people could run rings around them. And, you know, people took different positions at the time when it came to different disciplinary sort of cases. I mean, during lots of that period, I was just very frustrated at lots of people sort of poking the bear. So it seemed to me that there were lots of people saying things that were very, very unstrategic and sort of putting the party on a sort of a ground that was very difficult to defend. I think you have to be very disciplined when you're talking about this kind of thing if you've got, you know, the entire media establishment against you. But I mean, saying that, I'm sure, you know, there are things that people have said and done that they might have a different perspective on now. That period was a mess, though. Next story. Last week's local elections were a pretty big success for the Green Party. They gained 74 new councillors, bringing their total across England and Wales to the highest it's ever been at 812. In Bristol, they're now the biggest party on the city council, falling just short of a majority and gaining most of their new seats from Labour. They also made breakthroughs outside of the south of England, gaining their first ever seats on Newcastle, Sefton and Redditch councils. All in all, the Green Party seems to be gathering momentum ahead of the general election later this year, which means it's time for Labour to undermine them. This was the party's favourite attack dog, Peter Mandelson, talking about the Green Party on Times Radio.
The Green Party is becoming a dustbin, a bit of a repository, not only for climate activists, but for disgruntled hard leftists leaving the Labour Party and some fairly unpleasant hardline Free Palestine activists as well. They're all turning to the Greens. And I think whilst in the first instance the Greens look sort of bigger and emboldened, I think this is going to change the complexion of the Green Party. And I think they will rue the day when they threw open their doors to all these people.
Of course, it's pretty rich to hear Peter Mandelson lecturing other people about the company they keep when his judgment in that area isn't exactly spotless. This was Peter Mandelson celebrating his birthday with Jeffrey Epstein in Paris in January of 2007. Epstein would, of course, go on to be convicted of sex trafficking and other sex crimes. 2 years earlier, this was Mandelson and Epstein on a cozy shopping trip on the island of St. Barts. This is from 2005. And even in 2006, when Epstein was in jail on charges of procuring an underage girl for prostitution, Peter Mandelson couldn't stay away. This interview is with a friend of Epstein's who spoke to Channel 4's dispatches under condition of anonymity.
Epstein was free to continue to conduct business as usual, and our source says he witnessed an intriguing phone call.
While I was there, he received a call and said, "Hello, Petey." And he chatted away. And Petey wanted to meet Jamie Dimon, who was then the chairman of JP Morgan. And by the time he said, "Yes, I'll sort it out," put the phone down, and Petey turned out to be none other than the Secretary of the Board of Trade, Peter Mandelson. I was astonished that a British cabinet minister at that time, probably the most powerful man other than the Prime Minister, was calling Jeffrey in jail to make an appointment or to seek an appointment with a very powerful banker in New York.
Epstein was found guilty of procuring a minor for prostitution in 2008, but that didn't stop Peter Mandelson from remaining friends with the billionaire. A JP Morgan probe into its links with Epstein turned up this interesting snippet. Now, this is from the FT. It suggests that in June 2009, when he was the UK business secretary, Mandelson stayed at Epstein's lavish townhouse in Manhattan while the financier was in prison for soliciting prostitution from a minor. While he was the UK business secretary, he stayed at Epstein's house while the financier was in prison for soliciting prostitution from a minor. That is pretty incredible. Mandelson has refused to either confirm or deny that he used Epstein's apartment while the sex trafficker was serving time. Mandelson's swipe at the Greens hasn't landed without a response. The Greens' deputy leader for England and Wales, Zach Polanski, said this: Peter Mandelson, a lobbyist who represents banks, oligarchs, and gas companies, including Centrica, who mass sack their engineers. He runs a company that hires former Tory ministers and is now telling Keir Starmer to run the Labour Party. So that's from Zach Polansky, very well put. Saeed Siddiqui, the Greens parliamentary candidate for Ilford South, went for something a bit simpler. I am absolutely delighted to announce that Peter Epstein Mandelson has not endorsed the Green Party. Very well put. I mean, I think it's ridiculous that it's seen as legitimate to have Peter Mandelson standing or sitting sort of on a podcast, video camera there, saying, the Green Party are letting in all of these wrong-uns. You allegedly, and haven't denied it, stayed in Jeffrey Epstein's house while he was in prison for sex trafficking. You don't get to call other people dodgy, okay? Tell me, what did you make of sort of Peter Mandelson there?
Sanctimonious, hardline Palestine activists, these hardline people who believe that babies shouldn't have their legs blown off, etc., etc. My thoughts are sanctimonious, and then a word that I probably shouldn't say on on the news. The hypocrisy is clear for anyone to see, and explain yourself, Peter. Explain yourself. Explain why you're rubbing shoulders with kiddie fiddlers, and explain why you can't understand that kids getting their legs blown off is not hardline at all to oppose that. It's not hardline at all to think that that's something which should be condemned and something which should mean defection from parties that support it, should mean defection from parties that are happy to say, I do think Israel has the right to starve children. I do think Israel has the right to cut off electricity. I do think Israel has the right to do whatever it wants to ensure that that we can keep following the Americans. And also, we've got to remember that Britain was the country that basically helped form Israel. Britain has a particular historical role in this. Obviously, Palestine was under British mandate, and it was given to the Jews or the descendants of, I guess it was given to the Jewish people by the United Kingdom. And so it's so sanctimonious, it's so slimy, and it's so modern Labour is all I have to say about it, really.
Let's go on to our next video, which includes someone who's very modern Labour. We've often complained on this show that while TV hosts constantly ask their guests to condemn Hamas, they never do the same for Netanyahu, even though he has a lot more blood on his hands. Well, finally, Nick Ferrari has deployed that question. Watch how Labour's Jonathan Ashworth responds.
I obviously condemn Hamas. I also condemn the remarks of these very right-wing ministers in the Israeli government who have spoken out in the most extreme terms.
You condemn the actions of Benjamin Netanyahu?
I've condemned the ministers.
Yes, but what about the Prime Minister?
Well, look, right, you know, we will... This offensive into Rafah is going to be catastrophic, and it must not go ahead. That is our position. It's why
you're on the same page as Meir Khan. You condemn the actions.
We need an immediate ceasefire. We've condemned the extreme remarks of ministers in that government. We've condemned the
The Prime Minister, Mr. Ashworth. You condemn these actions?
We have made our position clear. Military intervention into Rafah is catastrophic, and we have condemned the very, very right-wing, extremist remarks of ministers in that government. Right. What we need is a peaceful initiative to bring about an independent, viable Palestinian state as part of a two-state solution and long-term and lasting peace in that region.
Do you condemn Netanyahu? We condemn some of the ministers in his cabinet. All right. Well, he says at the end there, he wants to do whatever's necessary to get a two-state solution. You know who has said publicly, very openly, that he will do everything in his power to stop a two-state solution coming to pass? In fact, sort of making that the raison d'etre of his political career, Benjamin Netanyahu, right? Why can you not condemn that guy? You know, sort of think about the corollary if this were Hamas and that was a Labour politician and that was Nick Ferrari. If Nick Ferrari said, well, you condemn Hamas, and he said, well, I condemn the killing of innocent civilians, say. You think he'd let him get away with that? Now, to be fair to Nick Ferrari, he did keep asking the question. I thought it was incredibly pathetic from Jonathan Ashworth. This idea, right, you got a war where 14,000 kids have been killed. And the only thing you're really willing to condemn is some things that some members of the cabinet have said, right? The problem with what Israel are doing isn't what some cabinet minister is saying. It's what the government and the army are doing, which is conducting a genocidal war. He's saying, look, we're very clear, we're very strong on this. We need to do whatever is necessary to get a two-state solution. And to do that, we're going to give a really easy ride to the prime minister, who has no intention of implementing a two-state solution, does everything in his power to block it, and then carries out a genocidal war, killing 14,000 kids. And let's look at Nick Ferrari have another go.
Don't they deserve equal condemnation, the ministers and the prime minister? Lastly.
I've condemned ministers in that government and the remarks that they're making. I've condemned expansion of settlement.
Why stop at the door of Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, because I've condemned the actions that are taking place in terms of settlements in the West Bank. An incursion into Rafah would be catastrophic. I've condemned the siege of Gaza, which needs to end. I've condemned all kinds of actions that are taking place, and I continue to condemn the remarks of some of those very, those very extreme ministers.
Reminds me of another conversation that's often had, because people say, you know, it's not anti-Semitic to criticize the Israeli government. You know, I criticize the Israeli government, but it is anti-Semitic to criticize Israel. Now, he seems to be taking it one step further, which is to say, you know, obviously we're not going to criticize Israel, but we're also not going to criticize the Israeli government. We're just going to criticize a few policies and some tweets by far-right members of the cabinet, sort of. You know, we wouldn't go so far as to condemn the Israeli government. We'll just condemn a couple of ministers for what they've said, and then a couple of actions which we're not that happy about, but we're not going to do anything to stop. Fermi, I thought, you know, Nick Ferrari, fair play to him for asking the question. I mean, obviously, you know, we're 6 months into this war. He wouldn't have asked it 5 months ago. It's taken a while. But I thought Jonathan Ashworth was particularly unconvincing there.
Well, not really fair play to Nick Ferrari, because I saw him ask the question to someone else the other day. A caller that was talking to him about something else, and he said, well, do you condemn Hamas? And then the guy said, well, this again, you're really going to ask me? And then within 2 seconds, Nick Ferrari said, okay, well, never listen to my show, never do this, that, and the rest, because you're not going to condemn Hamas, and therefore I've got no time for you. And he didn't do this with this guy, despite the fact that
fair enough.
Israel has done hundreds times worse. And you have a lot of this from media organizations, this posturing, this every now and then you'll throw in the occasional thing to make you think that you're being fair-sided, but you're not. I mean, LBC is not being fair-sided. LBC has fired their presenter because she grilled very slightly a Israeli governmental official. And of course, there is a complete... we are at the point where it's not that you should not condemn Hamas, it's that you should be nuanced and you should say, who has come to fight? Because I'm not a pacifist. I'm not a pacifist, you understand? I'm not a pacifist. I'm not Gandhi. I'm not Martin Luther King. I'm Malcolm X, by any means necessary. And if someone has killed, not just, and 40,000 is a gross underestimate. We know 40,000 is a gross underestimate. All of the record keeping ability, like all of the journal, everyone who can keep records of how many have died have been killed. And 40,000 has been floating about for weeks as an estimate, and therefore it's obviously more than that. I mean, famine is endemic throughout the north of Gaza, and people are still getting bombed. Today, people are getting bombed in Rafah. But this 40,000 is not the beginning. The beginning, obviously, is in 1948, and the beginning is with the initial Nakba, which itself then led to years of people being murdered, people being thrown in pits, people being driven from their homes, people, a slow genocide, which is continued over and over and over and over the years. And so the idea that you can say, well, Israel has a right to defend itself and therefore we should not condemn it, is blatant hypocrisy. I mean, in fact, this again, and I'm sorry for being so controversial today, but this ties back to the other kind of dispute within the Novara team recently about Mohammed El Kurd and these girls and the fact that they were wearing the paragliders on their back, and Aaron came out against them, and one of them was Palestinian. Now, saying that someone has broken out of a cage in which they've lived and been imprisoned for years since their birth And not making any. So these stickers did not have a picture of a beheaded baby on. They did not have a picture of a civilian being murdered on. They did not have a picture of any of that. And we know that civilians were killed on October the 7th, both by the Israelis who killed some of their own civilians and by Palestinians. We also know that a number of IDF soldiers, both current and previous, who are considered militants and who have been continually engaging in a genocide against the Palestinian people, including the people in Gaza, were killed as well. But it is not equivalent.
If you're saying IDF soldiers, both present and previous, you are talking about every Israeli citizen because they have to do military service,
well,
right?
So this drives back to the point that I mentioned last time. I was like, okay, so Hamas doesn't actively, I mean, sorry, yeah, Gazans, I mean, the Palestine doesn't actively take every one of its citizens and say, you were going to recruit you into Hamas and put a target on your back. Israel does. It forcibly says, we're going to put you in jail if you don't become a combatant for our. So Israel is the one who is saying, we are all soldiers. We have a society of settlers, and all of our roles are going to be to. And I'm not saying it. I'm saying Israel saying it. Israel has.
Yeah. No, but what I'm saying is international law doesn't make a distinction between, you know, someone who is a former soldier and has never been a soldier. It's just the case that it's in international law, it's legal to target military personnel. And it's not legal to target civilians, whether or not they formerly were in the military.
I wasn't justifying targeting someone who was, and I wasn't justifying it. I was saying that, look at the statistics, not just in this war where probably up to 100,000, maybe more Palestinians realistically have been, many more will be killed. We know it's going to be much more than 100,000 in the end. Look at what's happening in Rafah now. And civilians, we're talking less than 1,000 Israeli civilians have died. Let's talk about the fact that in all the previous wars, i.e. the slow genocide, the ratio has been skewed. Let's talk about the fact, who are the aggressors here? Who are the invaders here? And so let's stop with this wishy-washy discussion the only people, none of the international community, none of the Arab countries, no one the Yemenis have done their thing. The Yemenis have done their thing. It's what they can. But in terms of militarily coming in and assisting, no one has done it. So who's going to do it if not the Palestinian resistance? And so this idea that we should have to condemn the only people who are fighting a genocidal state, and we should have to condemn them, and we shouldn't condemn the genocidal state, and that we should tell off the people who give any allusions to these people, even if those allusions are just a picture of a paraglider of someone escaping a prison, not a picture of them shooting a civilian, not a picture of them doing this, is ludicrous. I come from a tradition, and I believe in a tradition, that if someone slaps, if someone has got their boot on your face, you don't beg them to remove it. And we need, as the left, to understand that a genocide is occurring. A genocide has been occurring, not just for the past few months, but for years and years and years. And if your people are being committed, if a genocide is being committed against your people, then you shouldn't have to condemn people who fight against genocide. And Hamas is not a ideal, perfect organization. And many people have their criticisms of Hamas. But for the UK media to say Israel has the right to exist when asked if they're going to condemn Israel, but say that Hamas is awful terrorists, this, that, and the rest. I think Israel has the right to exist. Doesn't have the right to exist, has the right to exist. Just as New Zealand has the right to exist, Australia has the right to exist, the United States of America has the right to exist. And what I mean by that is,
do you think the United States of America should stop existing? I mean, what's the argument?
No, I think the United States of America has the right to exist. In terms, I didn't say it should stop existing. I think logistically, okay, it would be stupid to say it should stop existing. But I do think it is a settler colony built on the death and genocide of the Native American people and mass enslavement of Africans, and is currently supporting a genocide, and is currently supporting a number of other genocides around the world, including in the Congo, through large multinational companies. And therefore, it definitely doesn't have any right to exist. Will the United States stop existing tomorrow? No, it's a huge power with massive, this and the rest. It'll probably stop existing tomorrow in its current form. The demographic changes of the United States of America mean that all these people scared about white genocide, America is going to change demographically. But no country has a right to exist. right. There's this motto, what is it? It's might is right. Might is right. Well, might is white, right? Might is white here. The white people, like the Europeans.
Well, I mean, I think 50% of the Israeli population aren't of European descent or of Arab descent.
Look at the cabinet. We've got Ben.
It's always been the Europeans who are sort of in political control.
Europeans who dominate Israeli society.
But actually, I don't think it's the Europeans that necessarily vote for the right. I mean, the majority of Israeli Jews are Middle Eastern, and the majority of them, you know, vote for parties that seem to want to do a genocide in Palestine.
The ones in power are the ones who have come from Poland, the ones who have come from the United States of America, the ones in power are the ones who look like Netanyahu. I mean, a lot of the Arab Jews are seen as cannon fodder. I mean, the Ethiopian Jews were sterilized. They brought them and they sterilized them so they couldn't have kids. They're like, fine, we'll bring you, but you're definitely not having kids because we don't want you here. We don't want your progeny here. So how are you going to sterilize black people and then tell me you're not a society with ingrained white supremacy?
Yeah, I mean, the point you were making earlier, I mean, my position on this is that it would be, you know, I don't demand people condemn Hamas, but I think it would be completely insane for a movement, if you want to build a big coalition to make as a dividing line, you have to not condemn Hamas to be a part of it, right? I think lots of people, I mean, I am very uncomfortable with the idea that you take part in an attack which kills a bunch of civilians, and I think civilians were targeted in that attack, right? I mean, I don't actually hold the position by any means necessary, because I think it can sort of end up just justifying random, wanton violence that doesn't actually benefit anyone. I think it's a bit of a nihilistic
attitude to have. By any means necessary doesn't mean random, wanton violence. I mean, Malcolm X didn't.
Well, I think there was a fair amount of random, wanton violence on October the 7th, right, wasn't there?
There was some random, wanton violence on October the 7th, and there has been in the history of Israel far more random, wanton violence enacted and inflicted on Palestinians. There has been since October the 7th far more random, wanton violence. And if some people on October the 7th, but the understanding I have is that it's likely that maybe the commands for these from the leadership of the military wing of Hamas were not to massacre civilians. They probably were to take hostages, which is a different question. But some people went off and did whatever they did under their own steam. Fair enough, right? You can criticize, right? But to then say you have to condemn
no one's saying anyone has to condemn. No one said that. I think what Aaron was saying in that tweet, I don't really want to focus too much on a tweet, but what he was saying is it's silly to seem to celebrate what happened on October 7th.
You haven't said it, but it's the main line in the UK press outside of...
Okay, no, it's just because in your answer, you're flitting between a criticism of the mainstream press and then a criticism of people on the left who don't like people celebrating October the 7th. There's sort of two very separate issues there.
That's the thing, it's not celebrate. I think you can celebrate people escaping a prison cage and not be celebrating the murders that took place. If you have something which has a picture of a murder on it, okay, you're celebrating a murder. If you have a picture of someone who has spent their whole life, and we know that many people left Gaza, we know that many people left, right? We know that some of them left, but there will be people who broke out who didn't massacre civilians and who have spent their whole lives in Gaza and have never escaped, right? And so, and as well, there's people who are not necessarily completely politically educated on the matters of that day. But the point of the matter is, there's a difference between actively celebrating the murder of civilians and making allusion to someone escaping out of a prison in which they've been held their entire lives.
I don't think it was unreasonable to associate a paraglider or a parachute 7 days after October the 7th with what happened on October the 7th. But people will disagree on this one. We should go to our final story. According to Gaza's health ministry, 34,000 people have so far been killed in Israel's assault on Gaza. In previous wars, the health ministry's figures have proved to be remarkably accurate. Yet Israeli officials have repeatedly dismissed them. They either say they're made up or that they know a huge proportion of the dead are what they call Hamas terrorists. And it's always been an unpersuasive argument from the Israelis. But speaking to Israeli spokesperson Avi Hyman, Piers Morgan, expertly, I think, demonstrated how their position is also completely incoherent.
Out of that Hamas number that you just gave, more than 14,000 are terrorists that we took out There's more than 25,000 Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists
many civilians do you believe you've killed?
We don't have exact figures, as you know, it's the fog of war.
But you've got exact numbers for Hamas terrorists you've killed. Why wouldn't you know how many civilians you've killed?
Because obviously our focus is to go after the Hamas terrorists. And
that does imply that you're putting a bigger premium on killing Hamas terrorists in terms of numbers and accountability than you are on innocent civilians. That can't be right, surely. If you know exactly how many Hamas terrorists you've killed, you must know how many civilians you've killed. Otherwise, you're prioritising the lives of terrorists over innocent people.
Piers, with respect, don't put words into my mouth, please. I didn't say exactly 14,000. I said around 14,000. Whereas Hamas will come out with precise numbers that statisticians will look at.
Give me a ballpark number for civilians.
Well, of course, you can use the ballpark as far as the Hamas figures, which I reject as being false.
That was really, really strange. A really embarrassing position for Avi Heiman to be in, right? He starts by saying the Hamas figures are false. Then he says that Israel has killed 14,000 so-called Hamas terrorists. But Piers Morgan then completely corners him, right? If Israel knows how many terrorists they think they've killed, surely they should know how many civilians they've killed at the same time. And Heiman then appears to tell Piers Morgan that to work out that, he should just use the Hamas figures, even though he says they're false. It doesn't make any sense, completely incoherent. Let's go back to the clip as Piers Morgan didn't let Heiman get away with that line.
Well, if they're false, why would you give me those?
I gave you the numbers that I had.
No, you told me you know how many Hamas terrorists you've killed, but you don't seem to have any idea how many civilians you've killed. I'm just bemused. Why wouldn't you keep count of both?
I don't have that information to give you, Piers. If I did, I would.
You've literally no idea how many civilians you've been killing.
I can tell you definitively that our aim is to go after Hamas.
No, we've done it successfully. I'm sorry to push you on this. That's quite extraordinary. You're an official spokesman for the Israeli government, and you have no idea how many civilians you've killed. I thought you just told me that you were particularly careful about not killing civilians. But if you don't know how many you've killed, how can you say that with any certainty?
Because even if you were to go by a ratio of the Hamas figures, we would still be far ahead of any
Western. That wasn't my question. You know it wasn't my question.
I don't have the information.
But you literally have no idea how many civilians you've killed.
It's not that I don't know. I'm not authorised to give the information. I don't have the information.
That's complete nonsense. Why are you authorised to give me the number of terrorists you've killed, but not the number of civilians? I don't understand. Can you explain?
Piers, we will go after Hamas. We will ensure that we...
You want me to believe you're being incredibly careful about how many civilians you're killing, and you have an amazing exemplary record, but you don't know how many civilians you're killing. So how do I know you've been careful?
Piers, when the dust settles, we will come out with the proper numbers.
Now, I've seen a lot of Israeli spokespeople be, unpersuasive. I mean, to often seem a bit sociopathic or psychopathic, but I haven't actually seen any of them just stare at the camera for, 30 seconds or so. I mean, and the reason he was completely stumped, and I'm actually surprised that I haven't seen this line of questioning before, because we have heard for so long that Israel both say, oh, we can't believe any of the numbers. How can anyone know how many people have died? And then they say, and we've killed 14,000 Hamas terrorists, right? You cannot hold those two positions at the same time, which I think Piers Morgan, was very good there at sort of drawing out. And Avi Heiman saying, oh, well, we'll find out afterwards. After the war, we'll find out how many people died. Well, if you're saying you're protecting civilian lives, which the Israelis are, everyone knows they're not, right? Then if you can say, oh, well, we'll find out how many of them died afterwards. That doesn't, to me, sound like they are giving a damn about protecting civilian lives. As we know, they're not. Thank you, everyone, for watching this evening. Come back tomorrow for another stream. For now, you've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.